Went down to the river, washed my sins away. Praying, 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 praying for another day. I went down to that river, washed my sins for free. The devil's on the other bank, staring back at me. I'm a dead man walking. I'm a dead man walking. I'm a dead man.
Welcome to Ars Politica Podcast. This is Stephen Wolf. Today we are going to talk about 17th century New England. But first, if you enjoy these podcasts and you enjoy video or audio content from me, then please go to Patreon to support me. If you can leave me a tip of a dollar or whatever, we can help you pay for some of these, some of the systems and the equipment needed to make this the best that can make it. It's at patreon.com/Stephen Wolf. Stephen with a PH and Wolf with an E. I greatly appreciate that. All these things do cost money and time, and so I would greatly appreciate anyone throwing in a dollar a month. That would be excellent. All right, so 17th century New England. This is the Baptist's favorite century and place, isn't it? The Baptists always like to appeal to this, and the Baptists somehow are always living through the threat of the Congregationalists coming back to get them. What happened in the 17th century New England, I mean Massachusetts and Connecticut, and for the most part today we're going to talk about the Boston area, but there were these four kind of separate incidents that people appeal to basically attack Puritan New England as being this persecuting, horrible place that we never want to return to. Now, what I want to do is talk about each of those four incidents, and those four incidents would be the incidents of Roger Williams, then next we have the Antinomians and the Quakers, and then the Baptists. In each case, you have the New England civil authorities essentially suppressing something about that incident. And so I want to talk in detail about each of those, because I think that a lot of what occurred and the process that took place in suppressing those people are not very well understood. And it's easy to jump to persecution. So you have books by people like Thomas Kidd. Thomas Kidd is a well-known evangelical historian. And when he talks about these situations, he'll just jump straight to persecution as if that's good enough. But actually, if you kind of dive into the sources, mainly the New England sources, this is actually what is neglected often when people study this period, even among, like I said, researchers. They always take the accounts of the persecuted, the quote persecuted, not the actual persecutors or the authorities. But in each case, the authorities actually gave an account of their what happened. And so I'm going to discuss what they said happened in these four different incidents. Now, there is, before I jump into Roger Williams, there is a sort of pattern that you'll see. There's a pattern that occurs in each of these incidents. The first thing you have to realize is that New England was, they established, let's just say, Massachusetts Bay Colony for a particular end. They wanted to establish a church-state relation that followed the Congregationalist way. Now, in our time nowadays, basically Congregationalism as a set of theology, doctrinally, is very similar to Presbyterian, but disagrees on the very Presbyterian, what makes Presbyterians, namely the ecclesiology. And that's parsing those differences is not important for the purposes of this podcast, but just to think of a Congregationalist back in 17th century was, broadly speaking, a Reformed Westminster type minus some of the ecclesiology. So that's the best way to kind of think of it. But nevertheless, they came to New England to establish the Massachusetts Bay Colony and also Connecticut for the purpose of having a church-state relationship that was Congregationalist. So that was the intent. So that's first thing to kind of realize. That puts things into perspective. So you have religious dissenters that show up and they contradict that. And so then what do they do? The intent of the colony is not religious liberty for all. That was not the intention, despite what you might have heard from someone like Ronald Reagan and conservatives and Reaganites. No, they came there to establish a Congregationalist way, civil church polity. Okay. Now, what would happen in each case is the religious dissenters would show up, and then they would either say or do something or both that would violate that original mission of the colonies. All right. And so then usually what happened after that is that there would be a dispute among ministers. The ministers, the sort of Congregationalist ministers, would then go use their means, which is oftentimes letters or public letters or debates or sermons that would then counter that those dissenters. So they'd start with the ecclesial action first. And then they would, the civil authorities would then suppress it. So that was always the pattern. It was always, and this is prescribed within the Reformed tradition when it comes to, like, you know, how to deal with heretics, is you first send out the word. If the word is ineffective because of the hard hearts of the heretic, then after that, if they persist in their public heresy and try to do soul damaging actions, then, well, they have to then be subject to the sword, that is the physical punishment, to ensure that that is silent, for the protection of the Commonwealth and for the souls of people in the Commonwealth. So that was the process established. Calvin says this as well. Very early on, this was affirmed. So, and every case, at least as the record I've seen, that is what New England does with each of these incidents. But then, of course, like the civil weapon comes up. The civil magistrate then suppresses these dissenting groups. Okay, so they are, quote, persecuted. After this happens, very quickly there is published by the persecuted group an account of what happens. This happens with Roger Williams, famously. This happens with the Baptists. This happens with the Quakers. Happens with the Antinomians. And then the New England authorities say, wait, they look at it and say, wait, that's not what happened. That's not what happened. And so then they write their own account. And this happened in every case. I'm not aware of the immediately reaction to the Quakers, but Cotton Mather, a few decades later, would write about it. So I'm going to appeal to Cotton Mather's writing about the Quakers. But that's the pattern. So there's persecution, allegedly, and then the persecuted write their account, and then New England responds with their account. And that's what happened. Unfortunately, in the scholarship, is people take the persecuted account, or the claims of persecution, and they take that as the historical, that's the record, like that's what happened. And they rarely then go to, like, you know, for example, you'll read, like, Roger Williams, A Bloody Tenet of Persecution. That's like something in college, often, if you're going to read something on a history, you're going to read that. And that's like, that's the count. That's what happened. But if you read the response to that, which came from John Cotton, you'll realize, wait, no, that's not actually, according to their account, why it wasn't because of his religious dissent. It was because of other reasons that they banished him. So, all right, well, let's just get right into that. The first incident is going to be with Roger Williams. Roger Williams, to this day, is claimed as this great defender of religious freedom. It is true that, in a way, he was ahead of his time. I don't know. It's not fair to say ahead of his time, but he was. His writings do reflect the later writings of the claims of sort of maximal religious liberty, and it could be easily used for that, precisely. Not just, hey, let's have a nice Protestant polity, we can tolerate only Protestants. No, it seems to be maximalist. Even though later on, that doesn't seem to have happened completely in Rhode Island, but that's a different story. All right, so Roger Williams was banished, and in 1644. So again, Roger Williams came a little bit later. He actually came before John Cotton, who was like his chief opponent in exchanging letters and all that, but or in writings. But he was banished. All right. He wrote The Bloody Tenet of Persecution for Cause of Conscience Discussed. It was in 1644. Most of the time, these are published in England because there are not any publishing houses in the New World, at least in New England, as I understand it. But so usually these were published in England, so they make a splash in New England, and everyone's like, oh, look what's happening down in England, New England. Now, you have to think what's happening in New England we'll get to this when we get to the Baptists, but just early on, just kind of set the context. You have the English Civil War and a lot of disputes happening between the six, of course, this even before, but 1630, 1640. So you have to think back there, you have the Anglican Church of the Episcopal Church trying to suppress dissenters, which would include Congregationalists, or over there known kind of as the Independents, which would include Presbyterians, which would include Baptists. And so the political interests of the people in England, or the, you know, the Britain generally, for the non-Anglican or non-Episcopalians, is actually religious liberty. And we'll get to this, but you have to think in the context, they're seeing these Congregationalists who in England as Independents are now asserting religious liberty. But now you're seeing the same sort of people, the sort of brethren, you know, think of the same denomination of sorts. Now those people are persecuting other people, the Baptists, the Antinomians, or now Roger Williams. And so you can see how the environment can create, it's not as if there seems to be a contradiction. You have the same sort of people in different places saying two different things, seemingly. All right, that's the context here. He publishes it. And then John Cotton later, who again is a kind of a later, he arrived a little bit later, he responds to Roger Williams. John Cotton explains that actually, no, you were not kicked out just because of religious reasons. It was not a sort of persecution for conscience. It was not that at all. So he gives a few reasons why Roger Williams was kicked out. He says one is that Roger Williams rejected essentially the patent for the colony itself. So King Charles I in 1629 issued essentially the right to establish these colonies. Okay, but Roger Williams was attacking the very foundation of the colony itself, saying that it was unjust against the Indians. And if you think about that, I mean, that's an opinion someone can hold. And actually, John Cotton says precisely that you can hold that opinion, and others did, and they were tolerated. But the way that Williams went, he said it was violent and tumultuous carriage against the patent. So he was attacking it. He didn't just hold the opinion and maybe state it. He was actively trying to get others to affirm it, which what does that mean? He's essentially denying the legitimacy of the very structure, political nature and of the colony itself. I mean, if it's illegitimate patent to begin with to have the colony, well, then all the authorities then are undermined. So you can see how this is attack on the authority itself. So this is John Cotton's words. By the patent, certain select men have power to make laws, the magistrates to execute justice, judgment upon a people, according to such laws. We have power to erect such a government of the church as is most agreeable to the word and the estate of the people. This flows from the action of the king, because it's the king's land first. He issued it in 1629. If that is null and void because of an unjust, then that means the power to make laws, which in a way flows from the power of the king in this case, is null and void. So then, that means the laws are essentially, Roger Williams, the logic of it suggests that you don't even have to follow the laws, which one could think is actually a problem. So that's the first one. And that's the stated reason. Again, it was Williams publicly and vehemently opposing it. Okay. So that's the first reason. That's the first reason that Cotton claims that why Roger Williams was banished. Okay. Yeah, and Cotton says here that it subverted the fundamental state and the government of the country. So that in a fledgling new colony that's only a decade or so old, that would be kind of a big deal. And also you have people arriving new to it at times. And now you have a guy saying, you know what, you actually don't need to follow the laws because it's unjust at the very root of it. Well, that could be a problem. The second thing for his banishment was that he rejected the idea of a civil oath. Okay, these were very important back in New England for political legitimacy and for obedience. So there was the fear at the time in the 1630s there was fear that a bishop had landed, or like a Jesuit, Jesuits had landed, and they were going about trying to convert people into the Jesuitical, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, basically. Now, this could just be complete paranoia. I mean, it's hard. Like nowadays, we have the media, and they'll go and discover and see what happened. You know, but here you hear rumors all the time, because the best you got is people walking along the way, and they said, "Yeah, there was this guy who was a Jesuit." Now they heard it from someone else, and then eventually a rumor started, and you don't know if it's true or not. There actually were stories like the Jesuits were hated by Protestants, and they would. The accusation is that Jesuits would show up and they would straight up lie. This is even in Turretin's Institutes, by the way, is in Institutes of Elective Theology. When he deals with the Ninth Commandment, he says, is it okay to lie for good purposes? And we're not talking about like Nazis in closets, or I mean Jews in closets before Nazis. What we're talking about is like, can you lie in order to then get into a church and then start subverting it, that sort of stuff. And Turretin's like, the Jesuits believe you can do that. So anyway, there was legitimacy to the claim that there could be these false people entering into society. So what happened? The governor of Massachusetts said, okay, everyone has to take an oath. In order for you to be a legitimate member of society, you have to take an oath, a civil oath. Now, an oath is something that falls under the third commandment. Okay, that would be governed under the third commandment. You have to take it not only outwardly, but inwardly. The issue with Williams was that, and this is something people have held, is that you can't require an oath, because an oath, in order to be legitimate, has to come from the heart. And in itself, like an oath is in itself not only an outward action, but an inward action as well. And so you cannot require it by law. You're actually, in a way, you're requiring people to lie. And this was something disputed, and actually John Cotton tries to refute it. But the point being is that if people cannot show up and take an oath, then you don't know, there's not, you don't have the sort of trust. You can't have the mutual trust that you need for a good, sound, healthy society. So in that sense, that's a second way that Roger Williams, who's vehemently, again, he's not just disagreeing. John Cotton again says people can hold this opinion, but he is trying actively to commit people to this, which would actively subvert the very foundation of government. So that's why Williams is suppressed. That's the second reason. And Cotton says that these are, Cotton says that these are the two most important reasons. He says these are the two reasons why eventually he was banished. All right, but there's another reason as well. The third reason, again, has nothing to do with his view of church and state relations, as famously thought. Before I get to this reason, Cotton even says, that New England perfectly permitted people who had that view to live in New England unmolested. But So anyway, the third reason is, so the church at Salem, because it's a congregationalist system, churches can decide for themselves who their ministers are. In a congregational system, it's basically independent. There's no presbytery, like Presbyterianism. There's a sort of regional church, and that consists of the teaching elders, and they are then kind of, anyway, I don't want to get into that. But the point being is that congregational, it's kind of an independent sort of system. Now, the church of Salem then brought Williams on as their pastor, and the church of the civil authorities in New England warned Salem that, hey, this is not a good idea. He's a nut. That's basically what they said, but they did it anyway. But because of the congregationalist way, they could not actually prevent, they would not prevent him. So he was a minister at Salem for a long time. Eventually the church at Salem said, I mean, this, who knows? I don't know exactly what happened in the background, but basically they said, we don't want you anymore. Williams, you're kind of crazy. One of the fears originated before was that Williams was the sort of firebrand who liked to condemn everyone. He liked to condemn everyone. People don't realize this, but, and Cotton says this directly, but the the mainstream of New England, of the New England ministers, they disagreed with the Church of England, but they didn't think that they had a false gospel. They did not think that they were not saved. Like this was one of the disputes between Cotton and Williams, was that, okay, let's say someone goes back to New England and they sit in and they have communion and they listen to the preaching of Episcopalian, of a Church of England minister who believes in kind of the Episcopalian way. Are they sinning by doing that? And Cotton says, no, if you go back there and you attend a church and you kind of submit to them in that way, that's fine. That's legitimate. You can do that in good conscience. But barring some of the things. So if you, they don't believe in bowing for Lord's Supper and all that, but the point being is if you actually listen to the sermon, maybe they tolerate you and let you take communion your way, whatever it is, that's not sinning. Whereas Roger Williams said, no, that is sinning. They come back. They ought to be under church discipline. If you have any participation in that system of the Church of England, it's idolatry, it's, papist. And so you can't do it. And Cotton disagreed. So Williams was highly sectarian. He was a sectarian guy. He was this sort of purist that you see among some Baptists nowadays. He was very much a purist. Well, that purity kind of annoyed, I guess, the Salem church. And they said, okay, you're out. And then Roger Williams proceeded to basically say that there are no churches because you're receiving people like this from England here without church discipline, then you're an impure church and you are basically no better than the churches in England. So basically Roger Williams is now accusing all the churches in England of being essentially quasi-papist, of being apostate, and only Roger Williams and his merry band are the actually true Christians. Salem said no. Eventually, when Roger Williams was banished, he was banished. He wasn't even heading a real church. His church consisted mainly of his family. So he was reduced to the purity of himself and his family. The whole time saying, you're all non-Christians, you're all no better than New England of England and the England Church of England. You're all no better than that. And so John Cotton says, he says, to observe the heady unruliness of his spirit and the incorrigibleness thereof of any church. So he had this sort of unruly spirit. He would go around and accuse people of not being Christians, not only the leaders, but also the churches and the ministers. All right, so you put all that together. You still might not agree that he was banished, but those were the reasons offered by John Cotton for his banishment. So again, undermining civil authority by saying that the charter to establish the colonies were unjust in itself. The other one being that you cannot take an oath, and therefore you cannot actually have this sort of mutual trust over the oath taking. And then the last one was that he was sectarian, extremely sectarian, to the point of declaring him and his family the only true church, but to the point where he would undermine the Christian nature of the project of the errand in the wilderness. He was undermining that project, and so they said, "Enough of you, Roger Williams, you're out." Of course, he wrote his account saying he was persecuted for his church state religion. And John Cotton said, "You know what? There are people here now who agree with you on that point, and they are tolerated here." But it was not that, or the other reasons why Roger Williams was banished. If you think about it, like, imagine this being, it's just a few thousand people. I don't know the exact number, but a few thousand people in this place, and a guy shows up, most people know why they're there. They know what the system is. They know the purpose, the intention of the colony. And a guy shows up and wants to undermine all of that. In that time period, it'd be very reasonable to kick Roger Williams out. But again, the dynamics of the transatlantic dynamics, and then Roger Williams claiming that it's because of his view of religious liberty and toleration, or just, that then created this sort of myth around Roger Williams, which is bunk. It's not true. It's all myth. it's myth for people to talk to, say Roger Williams is his great hero, when actually it was very reasonable to banish him. Even if you don't, you know, agree with that sort of thing, this fledgling society with that came here with a specific mission has this firebrand troublemaker, and they didn't kill him, didn't cut off an ear, they didn't smack him or whip him. They said, okay, Roger, you're out. Go somewhere else. And then he went on to do what, you know, found Rhode Island and all that. So good for him. But the fact is, all of it, it's complete myth. Roger Williams is not the hero you think he is, at least not in some of the ways people mention. And that's it. And so, some scholars have acknowledged this, and it's refreshing. So, but to just cite Roger Williams, this and that, and not actually understand the issue on the ground is to, I'm not going to say Roger Williams lied, but he definitely, if you think about it, if you were going to lie, you would go to England, or you would publish this thing in England. You would claim it's religious persecution. Why would you do that? Well, because again, in that situation, at that time period, you have the non-Episcopalians forming what would become the English Civil War, the new model army under Cromwell, which included Presbyterians, Congregationalists for Independence, Baptists, all sorts of, you know, levelers, all sorts of people. But this army to fight what? To fight, well, the Church of England army. So to fight the king and his being the head of the church and all that. So it would make sense to say, oh, it's religious persecution. And then of course you get the rest of history. So I think it's all bunk. But there you go. That's Roger Williams. I spoke longer than I intended. But anyway, this might be a longer podcast than I intended. All right. The next one is the Antinomians. Oh, poor Anne Hutchinson. All right, the Antinomians. So Antinomians, this controversy occurred in 1636 to 1637. And the big name is Anne Hutchinson. The other name, arguably the guy who tipped everything over the edge, was a lesser-known guy named John Wheelwright. An interesting thing about John Cotton in this is John Cotton was often accused of being an Antinomian. In fact, Anne Hutchinson came to New England because John Cotton was here in New England. And that's why she came over. And he was like a free grace preacher. And he was actually kind of defending what happened. I mean, early on, it was, I don't recall the guy's name. It'll come to me in a dream. But Thomas Shepard. The whole thing kicked off in 1636 with Thomas Shepard and John Cotton, Thomas Shepard being the hardline anti-antinomian and John Cotton being accused of antinomianism, because this sort of thing was already occurring back in England. Okay. So everyone kind of knew what this was, and they were kind of on guard for, to see if anyone has come over to New England with this opinion. So you have, ironically, you have Cotton, Hutchinson, and Wheelwright as the sort of antinomians of that period. Later, Cotton denies it. Later, he actually kind of, I don't know if he repents, but he does admit that that his defense of these people was unsound and unwise, because they were, end up being nuts. But anyway, Shepard and Cotton exchanged letters. You can read those letters now. They've been republished, and you can see them kind of defending themselves, accusation. Now, what happened was this became a serious issue, and it was, again, it started with the ministers debating back and forth, but it got to the point in that debate, because this was very much centered in kind of the Boston area. It became a huge issue with ministers attacking each other, and of course, Anne Hutchinson started this post-sermon Bible study. So after John Cotton's sermons, there would then be a sort of Bible study where you talk about the sermon. And that's where, in that context, that is actually where the sort of antinomianism started kind of spreading. Because then they'd take what John Cotton said, and then they would discuss it into full-blown antinomianism. So that's where Hutchinson came. Anne Hutchinson came in in all this. She didn't become a minister. It was in her own home, and she was wealthy because her husband was a merchant. So she was actually, you can imagine, you probably know women like this. but yeah, so they're very wealthy, and then bring all this together. She's very influential by means of her wealth and also her husband. And also she was friends with the governor at the time, Henry Vane. And so that's another incident we'll get into, but you have these high influences. It was a big issue. So on what happened then is the court or the New England authorities said, okay, look, the acrimony's high. We need to do something about this. So they called for a general fast, like a fast on January 19th, 1637. Okay. And the intent, this was a Sunday. The intent was no one's gonna eat food. It's all gonna be, hey, we need to calm down. And that's what they called for. Well, John Wheelwright decided to wake up and do violence, figuratively. He did a sermon on that day that was interpreted as basically saying that, you know what? Because you all disagree with me, all you anti-antinomians, he doesn't want to call himself an antinomian, of course, all you are not actually true ministers of the gospel, which in effect means that they're not real churches. So the people who disagree with me, which is the majority, are not true churches. All right. So that's what I did. All right. Everyone initially kind of lost their mind because of that. Here's a day where we're supposed to have cool minds and work through this prayerfully. Wheelwright shows up and does violence. Okay. So this is what, again, this sparked it again. There was disputes in between ministers. Eventually it got to the point where Wheelwright was, Winthrop. So at the time you got Winthrop, right? John Winthrop, he wasn't a minister. He's famous for the City on a Hill, what is it called? The Sermon on Christian Charity, that Reagan loved, of course. And he's now this political leader, and he says that that Wheelwright inveighed against all that walk in a covenant of works, as he described it, such as maintain sanctification as evidence of justification. But basically, the irony is you hear stuff like this from Scott Clark and others today. But if you have a certain view of sanctification as evidence of justification and other things, then that means you're placing yourself under the covenant of works, which essentially means you're outside the covenant of grace and you're not preaching the gospel. So there was a lot of dispute over that. So eventually this led to Wheelwright coming under trial. Why? Well, because he's arguing by saying that most of the ministers in New England are not actually gospel ministers, that most of the churches are not actually gospel churches. Therefore, the whole project is not Christian. It undermines the Christian nature of the entire project. And so, in fact, Wheelwright says that there's anti-Christian spirits and the spirit of Antichrist. Those who are up, this is what he says, those who are opposed to the way of grace brethren, those under a covenant of works, the more holy they are, the greater enemies they are to Christ. Those who oppose free grace have not the Lord Jesus Christ. All right, well, now he's saying all these people are not actually Christians. Well, this is a problem for the New England civil rulers. And so they basically say, Wheelwright, this is bad. And John Cotton was actually in one way a judge or kind of a witness in all this as well. And Wheelwright was banished. At the same time, Anne Hutchinson at the same time was also tried, and her views were more than just on sanctification. There was also some weird stuff in there that she believed that was also condemned. But again, why were these people banished? Well, they were banished because their theology of antinomianism was, one, considered dangerous because people then would not obey the laws. They were not bound to they were not encouraged to obey the laws, because obedience was something that was not, you didn't take an active role in your obedience. It was almost as if it just kind of flowed out and you couldn't look to it and all that. It was almost as if that the more obedient you are, the more you have to be scared that you're not actually justified. So that was the concern. It was undermined the very laws of the place. Also, the fact that, again, they had this sectarian spirit, which basically said that, well, if you're not on our side, then you are not a Christian. Now John Cotton does say, John Cotton does say in his dispute with Roger Williams, which again is he's writing in the 40s. John Cotton's writing in the 40s, and this is occurring in the late 30s, 1630s. John Cotton does say that the churches of New England do receive antinomians into their congregations as full members. So you affirming what they consider antinomianism is not in itself something that bars you from full membership. That means, of course, children are baptized. That means you can receive the Lord's Supper. And he said there are antinomians in our churches. They just can't espouse it violently. They can't try to propagate it. That would be suppressed. But the point being is that the New England folks can reciprocate in the sense they can say, okay, we disagree, but you can be in our churches as long as you don't try to spread the heresy, or spread the false, the error. Whereas on the antinomians on the other side are saying, no, you're not the Christian. We're the true Christians. So in a way, that this is the thing that people don't understand, is that New England authorities are suppressing sectarianism. It's the same thing with Roger Williams. Suppressing Roger Williams was, in effect, suppressing the sectarianism of Roger Williams. Suppressing the antinomians was suppressing sectarianism. This is actually also true with the Quakers and with the Baptists, as we'll see. It was the action of the civil authorities that suppressed sectarianism, not necessarily the false views in themselves. All right, so unfortunately, it's a sad story. Hutchinson is banished with her husband, and they're all killed by Indians. It's very sad. There was actually a very unfortunate comment by one of the ministers that said that she got what she deserved, something like that. Very unpleasant. Back then, you can kind of understand that they would understand events as have spiritual significance. So if you really didn't like Anne Hutchinson, which in some ways could be justified, for her spirit and all that. So that happened. But anyway, but that's just one minister saying something that is irresponsible. That's the antinomians. The antinomian controversy pretty much was dead after that. So again, it was mainly kind of had a civil concern. This project has a certain nature, and the antinomians were very powerful. As one scholar has basically shown, that the antinomians tended to be, a guy named Valeri, with a historian, Mark Valeri. He's shown that antinomians were actually usually the wealthy merchants. And this goes to a broader understanding of the nature of the merchant class tended to be on the side of the antinomian side, meaning kind of having lighter, because the merchants didn't like the ministers because the ministers were always trying to insert themselves in economic affairs and financial and transactional affairs. And so the merchants kind of wanted to reduce the clergy's involvement, their moral involvement, with like morally condemning certain economic actions and financial and commercial activity. So, but at the same time, they also wanted to have more religious liberty, because religious liberty would essentially open up markets. It would basically, they wanted the more acquisitive, acquiring society. And the New England Puritans, contrary to what people think, actually were the sort of anti-capitalist in a way. They wanted to bring more moral judgments into commercial activity. And so the fear of New England was that these merchants were, that there was a class interest a merchant class interest in antinomianism and religious liberty. And Thomas Shepard says that actually explicitly. I don't have that quote in front of me right now. But Thomas Shepard does say something along those lines where he said, you guys basically want this. Well, this other guy. So a guy named Edward Johnson is a New England minister, said that they would willingly have had the Commonwealth tolerate diverse kinds of sinful opinions that their purses might be filled with coin. There's another one here that says that they want to run it, they're running after new fashions, taking up with the fashions of every nation. Basically, they're again turning into commercial society. So that was the fear too. So you have to then see the antinomian controversy as mixed in with a class, merchant class, commercial, like free market sort of approach. Okay. So which was suppressed when they suppressed the antinomians. All right, the next one are the Quakers. The Quakers. Everyone loves the Quakers. No. Nowadays the Quakers are these nice, usually short-haired women who are very liberal, and we're supposed to think that they're actually very friendly. And no, the Quakers back in the 17th century were insane. They were probably mentally disturbed. They were lunatics. I'll quote Cotton Mather back in the early 1700s. He said they were madmen, a sort of lunatics, demoniacs, and energumens. I don't know what that word is. Huh? So they were essentially mad. They were madmen. And they would show up, naked. Like, they would run through a church naked. The Samuel Sowell, an important merchantman, also anti-antinomian, but anti-antinomian, he said that in his diary, he records that one woman was wearing like a bag, nothing but a bag, and was doing essentially what we call nowadays blackface. She had ink all over her face, and she was babbling nonsense in the church. So these people were nuts. And and back then they would, their own writers would basically say that they are free from government. They're kind of like not exactly, it's not fair to say they're radical Anabaptists, but they overlapped with some Anabaptists and basically saying that they're utterly free. I don't have to listen to you, government. They rejected all sorts of things. So like, they opposed, Cotton Mather said they opposed good order, both civil and sacred, erected in the colony. They wouldn't like acknowledge. Yeah, they were, he said that they do not own any government for God's ordinance, and those who witness to their light within, but those that witnessed to their light within, and they carry every, they think that all rulers, judges, justices, lawyers, constables must be cut down for the light alone to rule. So there's a sort of inner light. It's a weird theology. And the only thing that should rule people is this sort of inner Quaker light. So they basically were, again, opposed to everything in the colony. Then this is the 1650s. Okay, so think of the colony is only 2 to 3 decades old. The people who were born there are now in their 20s or teens. It's still a very small colony. There was an intention for this colony, and the Quakers are utterly opposed to that, everything. And they're also nuts. Okay. They always talk about the fact that ministers were, or not, excuse me, that, a few of the Quakers were killed. It is true that there were some Quakers killed, but people don't realize what led up to that. First of all, they're always nuts. They're crazy. They are essentially a public disturbance. I don't mean just because they shout their opinions from a box, but they rush into churches. They scream at people. They denounce ministers. But they also should have got the point. Quakers would show up from England, and they'd land on the ship, or they'd land and they'd leave the ship. They do the Quaker thing, and the New England authorities say, "Nope, you're not allowed to be here. Turn around, go back." And that's what they did. They'd go back, and then they'd come back. They'd land in, say, Virginia, and somehow come back. Same people. I'm not just saying Quakers in general would come back. The same people would come back. And New England would say, "No, you're out of here. Go away." Then they'd come back a third time. And they're like, "Well, you got to go." They'd imprison, they'd whip them, because there weren't jails, like normal jails back then. This is what they did. You give a corporal sort of body punishment, and you'd hope that that would reform them. They don't want to have that happen again. They'd go back. They'd go and then come back and through different means. And then eventually, yeah, there was like cutting off ears. It's very, very, very kind of, I mean, stuff like that was actually kind of common, but it was to prevent more Quakers. But then they'd come back again. And they passed the law. Boston then passed the law and said that if you're a Quaker, you come back and you're crazy again, we're going to execute you. So they had the law. They came back. But they did not execute him then. Then they kicked him out again. But then they came back. I'm not exaggerating. This is what happened with the Quakers. You know, it's like we would, like, imagine, I don't know. I mean, like, imagine you have this small town and, like, these nutty communists keep showing up. And you say, look, you got to leave. You guys are not welcome here. And they keep coming back and being disruptive. I mean, yeah, we wouldn't kill them. But I'm saying that's like in the 17th century, what do you do? And eventually they said, okay, enough is enough. And they end up executing some of them. Later on, Cotton Mather, he did not like the idea of executing heretics. And he was against that. But he does say basically that it's kind of understandable because they were nuts. They were crazy. What do you do with these people? So it wasn't, you can't think of the Quakers as being a bunch of short-haired, like, my picture of a Quaker nowadays is like this older woman with short hair who's liberal and waving a rainbow flag. Like, that's not the Quaker of the 1600s. They've calmed down. They, I guess, realized their mistake or whatever. But back then, they were not like that. All right, so, yeah. Like, they persecuted, they killed the Quakers. Well, yeah, the Quakers were insane. I'm not saying they should have, but you have to understand the context of what's happening. The Quakers were not normal people. They were probably mentally disturbed. Cotton Mather says they probably had demons. Yeah. All right, next is, so that's the Quakers. I've covered Roger Williams, the antinomians. Again, so all the three so far, again, it's you people are dangerous for our society. They went through the process, and eventually they said, okay, you're out. And only so far that the Quakers have been killed. All right, now you get to the Anabaptists. Now, the Anabaptists, when I say Anabaptist, you should be able to call them, the New England authorities would call them the anti-Pado-Baptists. So they didn't want to call them the Baptists or the Anabaptists or the anti-Pado-Baptists. It's kind of like nowadays, I don't like calling Roman Catholics Catholics because I want to claim the word Catholic for myself, like all the confessions do. But anyway, I'll call them the Baptists just to be nice. But yeah, so the Baptists. Now, the thing with the Baptists is that in theologically, these Baptists that came to New England, theologically, they're not far from Congregationalists because they are what we call Calvinistic. They are Congregational, but they differ on the baptism issue, which is hugely important. So you have to understand why this is very, very important for that time. If you have a society that is baptized as infants, a Baptist who shows up to that colony, which again, that was the intention of the colony, was to be a Pado-Baptist Congregationalist civil church relations, right? And you show up to that colony as a Baptist, you don't think anyone around you is legitimately baptized. Not even that it was illicit, but that it's invalid. It was invalid baptism, which means it was no baptism at all. Even to this day, Baptists have to deal with, let's say, a guy who's baptized as he's a Pado-Baptist. He wants to be a member of church. What do you do with this guy? You don't believe he's actually validly baptized. You're going to allow him to be members, or you're going to allow him? So this is a very complicated subject for Baptists to this day. But anyway, you show up to this place, and all of a sudden, you are basically saying that no churches around you have true baptized believers. And it would be easy to go from there to say that it's not a true church. that you don't actually have any. If you believe that baptism itself kind of sets you apart, it's sacramental, or at least some sort of ordinance that is crucial ordinarily for the spiritual life. What are you going to do? Well, so that is a problem. Wouldn't that be a problem? And now you start a Baptist church in the midst of a bunch of paedo-Baptist churches, and you're essentially saying that you're the true church, and you cannot reciprocate. This is the thing. A Presbyterian a Presbyterian or Congregationalist church can receive Baptists into their congregation as full members without hesitation, because they are legitimately baptized, because paedo-Baptists affirm adult baptism, right? So they affirm that. My church just did an adult baptism a couple months ago. So we do adult baptism. We also just think that children should be baptized. Children are believers. But Baptists cannot reciprocate, okay? So in this sense, the Baptist church is the sectarian church among a non-sectarian network of churches in New England. New England can have antinomians as their members. They can have people who believe in Episcopalianism as their members. They can have Baptists as their members. They can have Presbyterians as their members. And that's just precisely what John Cotton said earlier, is that in our churches, we have all these people. John Cotton says, we even have Baptists in our churches. We have anti-paedo-Baptists in our churches. Baptists cannot reciprocate, or at least they couldn't at that time. And this is what even though Cotton Mather doesn't like the sort of civil actions, he does kind of say that this was a problem even to his day. I mean, we'll get a little bit to his story a little bit more, but he says that, like Cotton Mather says, that these Baptists are worthy Christians, they're holy, watchful, fruitful, heavenly people, as perhaps any in the world. So he has great respect for Baptists. And he says that we've welcomed them into the communion of our churches. This is Cotton, John Cotton writing in the early 1700s, 1701, I think, is around there, early 1700. But the problem is, as he points out, that again, they cannot reciprocate. I'm trying to find the quote now. Mather says, they unchurch all the faithful upon the earth besides themselves. That is, they are, they're sectarian. He says, because for them, the administering Baptist marks off the, quote, visible saints, right? He says that they declare infant baptism to be a mere nullity. With them, therefore, our churches were no churches of the Lord Jesus Christ, nor are there any visible saints among us, right? The baptism marks off visible saints. If you don't have the proper baptism, you don't have the mark of visible saint. And so he says they would not own the churches of New England, that they are true churches. Okay. So again, you have people showing up to a colony that has an explicit outward, everyone knows what they're about. They're Congregationalists in the state-church relation. You have Baptists showing up, want to start churches, that then essentially say that no one around you are visible saints because they're not baptized. Okay, I mean, think about that. Think about that. That's what they're doing. but Mather says we let them enjoy all the ordinances and fellowship of our churches. That is, we disagree on the baptism issue, but you are welcome to the Lord's table with us as co-members, fellow heirs of Christ, as in union with Christ. Isn't it understandable that these people in New England, who again came to establish a certain system, are now thinking, why have you come? Why are you here? Why didn't you go somewhere else, to like Rhode Island or other places where you can exercise your religion freely? We came here for this end, and you are welcome as long as you don't try to subvert it. And that's precisely what Baptists, whether or not that was their intention, that is the easy way to interpret it as they come over and try to proselytize. So the Baptists, it was a dispute, in the 50s, in the 60s, the 70s, was a long-running dispute with Baptists. What they did was simply the New England authorities denied Baptists the ability to establish their own churches. That's pretty much what it was. It kind of came to a culmination in the late 70s. So in the late 70s, you have Increase Mather, who's the father of Cotton Mather. And then you have someone like Samuel Willard, someone I respect highly. So you have these guys in that period writing against the Baptists. And there was a book by a guy named John Russell. It's titled Narrative. Basically saying, accusing New England of persecuting Baptists. Which again, this follows the same pattern. John Russell is persecuted. He publishes in England. And now it's claiming persecution, and now the New England authorities have to respond to that. And the people who respond to it are kind of the heavy hitters of that time, Increase Mather and Samuel Willard, in a title, Nesuter Ultra Crepidam, which basically means it's like not beyond the shoe, which is an expression saying that you should not exceed your expertise. You should not go beyond your expertise. But basically, they're claiming that you Baptists don't know what you're talking about, which they're often uneducated and wild. And so, but that's not to deny that there were, of course, there were well-educated, very smart Baptists. But anyway, just leave it there. But this is an very interesting, I think, neglected publication. Mather wrote the preface, and the preface is actually really interesting. It's something you should not skip over. This is what Increase says. He says, "Should men of any other persuasion whatsoever have done the like," that is the sort of actions of the Baptist, "the same severity would have been used towards them. If any men, either of the Presbyterian or Congregational persuasion, in matters referring to church discipline, should behave themselves as the Anabaptists in Boston and New England have done, I think they would have deserved far greater punishment than anything that to this day that have been inflicted upon them." That is the Baptist. Now, what would that include? Would it include things like the New England churches would excommunicate someone, and then the Baptists would receive them? That was one thing that they were offended. And really, Samuel Willard details everything. He actually argues against the Baptist position on sort of like pure church mentality, which is, again, all these things. It's ironic that New England are called the Puritans, and yet actually they're the ones trying to suppress these sectarian purists. Now, there is at the time, so what happened was you had John Owen and Thomas Goodwin write a letter, because they're in England, writing a letter to New England saying, "Hey, you guys got to calm down. We hear you're persecuting Baptists. That's not good. You shouldn't do that." And why? Well, because they were part of this kind of religious liberty movement, because they were in England under the Church of England, you know? So partly, and actually Mather references this within his preface, but there's one paragraph in there that I want to read in full, that I think is really interesting. It basically is intended to justify their actions to their denominational compatriots. Okay, so this is Increase Mather. Again, this was published in 1681. Okay, he says, "It is evident that toleration in one place is not only lawful, but a necessary duty, which in another place would be destructive, and the expectation of it irrational. That which is needful to ballast the great ship will sink a small boat. If a considerable number of anti-Paedo-Baptists should, as our fathers did, obtain liberty from the state to transport themselves and families into a vast American wilderness, that so they might be a peculiar people in themselves, practicing all and only the institutions of Christ. If now Paedo-Baptists should come after them and intrude themselves upon them, and when they cast men out of their society for moral scandals, entertain them, Surely they would desire such persons either to walk orderly with them or to return to the place from whence they came. And if they would do neither, they would think that such paedo-baptists were blameworthy. Let them then do as they would be done by, and deal with us as they would have us deal by them, were they in our case and we in theirs. So if the Baptists created a colony and had a certain intention for it, and the paedo-baptists, the Presbyterians or congregationalists showed up and said, you know what, we don't care, we're going to start our own church and meddle and subvert and bring people in that we excommunicated in our churches, well, wouldn't increased Mather's point is, you would not like that, we don't like it, why didn't you go somewhere else? There are other places where you can practice your Baptist religion freely and unmolested, but you come here knowing that we as New England Congregationalists have a certain way about us. There's also the early on, it shows that he's talking to, again, he's addressing like John Owen Goodwin. He's saying, look, over there in England, it makes sense that you guys would want religious liberty because there's high diversity. But here we're this small colony, you know, several thousand people. We have a certain intention from the beginning. We have civil authority to effectively suppress dissent. And that's what we're going to do. We can do it here. Over there, if there's, you know, maximal Protestant diversity, you cannot force upon these people the Presbyterian or the Congregationalist or the Episcopalian way. You can't do that. You do what you can. You aim at the good, but you can only approximate the good given the circumstances. In this case, we are a majority. We're going to maintain the majority according to our way. So again, it shows the flexibility. People don't recognize it about the Reformed tradition. I try to do this in my book, Case for Christian Nationalism, show that there's flexibility. You have to take into account traditions and circumstances and characteristics. And here is Mather pointing straight directly to that. So that's his argument against the Baptists. The Baptists, of course, were whipped in the ears and all that, I understand. And Cotton Mather later says this was something they should not have done. He kind of laments all that. And yet I think we need to put in perspective, like increase Mather's perspective here, that again, they seem to be, why are you here? All right. And also, again, it's not just why are you here, it's that the Baptists, by the nature of their position on baptism and their understanding of ecclesiology, are in direct contradiction to the established way of New England. Whereas New England can receive Baptists without contradiction, but the establishment of Baptists as a legitimate sort of denomination or group in New England is directly contradictory to the very nature of that colony as instituted, as established. Okay. So something to consider, I think, when you think about the Baptist back then. All right. So that is, those are the four, the big four. And again, you see the pattern. The pattern is that you have an established way. Dissenters contradict that way, sometimes in ways that are very dangerous in terms of Roger Williams, the antinomians in particular. The Quakers were never a serious threat. They're more like a nuisance. But the antinomians or Roger Williams and antinomians were serious threats to the political order, to the established political order. The Baptists, I don't think they were serious threats, but they were subversive and could have been worse had they converted a lot of people. So that's what happened. They would contradict the congregational way of New England. They would then be addressed by ministers, and then they'd be addressed by the civil authorities, and then they would publish something in England that claims that they were persecuted, and then the And then New England would respond saying, no, this is actually what happened. I hope that at the very least, my discussion has shown that these situations were complex and that from a certain era or frame of mind, if you want to say, if you will, the response to them was reasonable. Okay. According to the, it was reasonable, or at least there were reasons. It wasn't this, like, usually New England, like, Puritans are presented as, like, violent, fervent, like, firebrands who are, like, running around trying to round up heretics and testing people, and just the slightest error, they throw in the, you know, they start chopping off ears. No, it was far more complex. It was far more reasonable and deliberate and thoughtful. Even if, like Cotton Mather later on would say, look, there are things they went overboard. They shouldn't have done this. They shouldn't have done that. Nevertheless, they were not, first of all, they were not the extremists. They were not the sectarians that they're usually described as being. They were suppressing the sectarians. They did not utterly reject the Episcopalian or the church, the English church. That is, they obviously had many serious disagreements with them. I mean, John Cotton was essentially run out of the Church of England and others. But they still affirmed that they were gospel churches. They preached the gospel, but there were just serious disagreements. A more extreme compared to, of course, our time. But I'll just leave that. The last thing I want to say before I end this, because it's been about, I guess I've only done about an hour. It's pretty good. Okay. The last thing I want to say is between the Congregationalists and the Baptists was John Cotton's action in 1717, I believe it was. So in Boston, after the restoration of monarchy in England, there was essentially religious liberty enacted everywhere. So this included in New England. So that it was illegal by order of the crown, pretty much, or by order of the English state, that there will not be persecution of fellow Protestants. Okay. And what this meant then is that 1690 up to the 17 teens and beyond, it was, you could not do that. So basically Baptist Rome freely had the churches and all that sort of thing. But in 1718, not 1717, there was the ordination of a Baptist minister named Elisha Callender. This is again in Boston. And who gave the ordination sermon for Elisha Callender? None other than Cotton Mather. So Cotton Mather, we've already read in his Magnalia Christi Americana, he does talk about, he's the guy who said that they went overboard, but the Quakers were nuts and all that. But now he, a Congregationalist, is now giving the sermon for Elisha Callender to be installed in the Baptist church in Boston. It's a pretty important event that I think a lot of people miss. Another significant thing about that is not so much that Cotton Mather did that. That's not totally surprising. But in the audience is Increase Mather, the father of Cotton Mather, the same Increase Mather who in 1681 published Nisupra Crepidam, whatever it was, that was justifying their actions against the Baptist. And in the election sermon publication, because of course back then they would publish their sermons on paper, there's a preface, and the preface is written by Increase Mather, the father of Cotton Mather. So something had changed. Now you could have the more cynical view that now they wanted to have an alliance against the encroaching Church of England in the area or something like that. But or you could think of it more positively, which is, hey, they figured out that as fellow Protestants, they could get along well and serve together in a civil polity and be pan-Protestant. You agree on most things, and it can come to the point where you have mutual respect. And you don't have to see each other as subversive. There was, I think, also the installation of a confident majority that can tolerate minorities. So this is what people don't often realize, is that the toleration is often the result of a majority saying, we are confidently in the majority, and we're confident that you're not going to become the majority, and so we're going to tolerate you. You know what I mean? Like, there's this, it's only when the minority becomes a threat that the majority then wants to suppress the minority, right? Because, and this could happen either because the minority becomes really strong or the majority becomes weak. So in this case, I think it was just the realization of Congregationalists that they are a comfortable majority, and they remained the comfortable majority until immigration in the 19th century. So in that sense, they were right. They were able to say, we can have a pan-Protestant order knowing that the Congregationalists are going to be the predominant people within New England. Okay. But anyway, nevertheless, it was an important moment. Congregationalist Baptists coming together. And it kind of, I think this really captures the importance of experience over time within Protestantism to say, and this was, again, it was recognized all the way back to John Cotton, that Baptists are our brethren, that Baptists are fellow Christians, and we have a serious disagreement. But what happened is experience began to dictate that, wait, we don't have to suppress them in this circumstance, because we can get along in a common project of a sort of pan-Protestant order. And I think that actually, that event in 1718 really captures what became of America into the 19th century, and we've only lost actually in the last few decades. I think, well, there's a lot to say about that, but so that's my discussion of the so-called persecutions of New England in the 17th century. Again, highly misunderstood, and so I thank you for listening. And again, if you like this, please share it with your friends, and I'll be doing more of this. All right, thank you.
Went down to that river, washed my sins away. Praying, 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 praying for another day. I went down to that river, washed my sins for free. The devil's on the other bank, staring back at me. I'm a dead man walking, I'm a dead man walking, I'm a dead man walking.